As we were sitting quietly, I found I was reflecting on some of the words from the Mangala Sutta, the discourse on the highest blessings that we were chanting at the beginning of the evening. These lines, although involved in worldly ways, unshaken, the mind remains. Putasa loka dammehi chitam yasa nakampati. Asokang virajang kemang, and beyond all sorrow, spotless, secure, these are the highest blessings. Well, the Loka Dhamma in Buddhist tradition, what is translated in this version as worldly ways, is also often rendered as the worldly winds. And in the vast collection of the Buddha's lists, there are 8 worldly winds enumerated. And so that this is always something that's helpful to contemplate. The worldly winds that are those forces that can be very powerfully buffeting us, motivating us, moving us, shaking us. And how do we find security in that storm? The I guess also it's brought to mind by the terrible hurricane that hit the south coast through New Orleans and through the southern states. But the he's got his pen and his paper ready. The 8 worldly winds are happiness and unhappiness, gain and loss, praise and criticism, and fame and disrepute. These are the 8 worldly winds. And flipping through virtually any magazine or newspaper, or even just taking a look around your own family, or even your own mind, might reveal to us very quickly how powerful these forces are within our society and how strongly they influence us. Just the pressures of fame, the desire to be famous, the fear of disrepute or the disgrace of having an infamous reputation. Stories of gain and loss. Someone who's immensely rich or suddenly struck it lucky. Or people who suddenly lose everything. Not even suddenly, even slowly lose everything. The happiness and the unhappiness, the happiness of those who have good fortune and for whom things go well, and the sorrow of those experiencing tragedy, loss. And the view is very familiar to us, isn't it? Happiness, unhappiness, praise and criticism, fame, disrepute, success and failure. If you said, okay, how much is there in this magazine that doesn't involve any of these 8? It's going to be sort of the byline of the printer's name and address. Not every journal or newspaper, but if we consider, if we look around, we see how much of our attention is taken up, is swept up by those qualities. How much energy we burn finding ourselves concerned with these in our own lives, wanting happiness for ourselves, fearing unhappiness, wanting in gain, fearing loss, wanting and delighting in praise, fearing criticism. Maybe not all of us would like to be famous, but most of us would prefer not to be infamous. Maybe in the East Bay it's kind of different. Sort of delight in being having a chic degree of infamy. So these are amongst the forces or the qualities that have a powerful influence on us. And so in the Buddhist tradition, in using Buddhist practice, it's always helpful to take a look at those forces, those elements of the world, of our lives, of our minds, that do have a powerful effect. What do we do with them? How do we handle them? And as in this verse in the Mangala Sutta, the Buddha outline these sort of down at the refined end of the highest blessings, up near sort of just the verse before Nibbana and realizing the Four Noble Truths. So it's these are kind of right up there. How do we find that quality of unshakenness? Chitang yasa nakampati, that the jitta that is not shaking, is not quaking, that is unmoved or free from wobbling in the face of these qualities. And this is certainly difficult. Yeah, this is not easy for us. The instinctually we're triggered. On one level we might think of ourselves as rational beings or spiritual beings, but as I often contemplate and like to point out to people that we have about 150,000 years of hunter-gathering. Prior to our the last sort of 10,000 years of building cities and having educational institutions and being able to write and juggle conceptual thought to the same degree that we do now, that we are very much driven by and affected by the world of our instinct, the hormonal world, and the dictates of the hunter-gatherer mindsets, and these qualities of gaining and losing, happiness and unhappiness, these more sort of primal qualities. The rational mind says, "Well, gain or loss, I don't really care. It's all the same to me." Happiness, unhappiness, yeah, I understand that. If you cling to happiness, it makes you suffer. If you cling to unhappiness, well, you suffer right there. Yeah, it makes sense. I understand that. Okay, what's next? Praise and criticism? Yeah, well, I don't really care what people think about me. It doesn't make much difference. The rational mind can sort it all out and have it neatly straightened up and all in order very, very easily. But then when it actually hits... that moment where things do fall apart, when the losses do happen, then it's a bit different, isn't it? A few years ago, I was on the board of Spirit Rock, and for a couple of years, I was a board member, and one of the meetings that we had was on the day that there was a gigantic stock market crash. And the meeting happened anyway, and I was surprised how many people. I think I was the only person in the whole circle of maybe 18 people who didn't actually own any stocks or shares. And one particular person, one board member, was actually some kind of a stockbroker or financial dealer of some sort. And he, interestingly enough, he said that just before he woke up that morning, he had a dream of standing on the deck of a beach house and watching this huge wave coming in from the ocean and sort of rising up at the beach. And he woke up just before the wave hit him. And then he, being a good stockbroker, woke up and switched on his screen and took a look at what the stocks had been doing while he was asleep, and realized that an extremely large proportion of his assets had just evaporated. And then he had to come to the board meeting at Spirit Rock. So, you know, that when he lay down to sleep, he was a rich guy. When he woke up at 6:30 in the morning, he wasn't. And he knew, you know, I've been practicing Buddhism for a long time now, and I should be equanimous, but I've lost everything. It also reminds me of a story of same feeling, but you know, different location. This was a guy who used to be very close to our monastery in Thailand, the monastery where the Western monastics live in Thailand, Wat Phananachat. And when I lived there in the late 70s, he was the kind of head layman. He would always do the request for the precepts and the Dhamma talk and so forth, and was a sort of prominent member of the village, and he was always around the monastery helping out and doing things. And he, like many people at Northeast Thai villages, had a big family, and again, 8 or 10 kids, and had worked pretty hard over the years. But one of the things that he did was that as he worked and earned what money he could, he squirreled away a certain proportion of his earnings into a mattress in his home. And rather unwisely, he didn't let his wife know that he had been saving a certain proportion of their income by stuffing it away in the mattress. And this had gone on for many years. You know, it's quite a length of time. So there was a very substantial proportion of their savings stuffed in this mattress. And one day he'd been away for some time, and he came back and he saw this large plume of smoke coming up from behind the house, and he got back and found that his wife had had a bit of a clear out and had a bonfire going in the backyard, and on the bonfire was the charred remains of the mattress. And not quite all the money was gone, but most of it was burnt and gone up in smoke. And you know, she hadn't realized, and was cheerfully piling other things on the fire and keeping the flames going. And there was all of the all of the family savings just gone. So these are the kind of moments that we're tested in, aren't they? They are things that are very difficult for us. But yeah, also, you know, we each have our own character and our own foibles. And you think, well, you know, money, shmoney, comes, it goes, you know. But then, and really feel that, and that really might be the case. But then we look at some of the other ones, fame and disrepute or praise and criticism, and things go a different way. You know, that's those are the hormones that that strike. And we survey for ourselves which are the ones that really affect us and have the most power. There's a story they tell in the Zen tradition, whether it's a true story or not, it doesn't really matter, it's a good story. It's one that always gets, very regularly gets quoted in this regard, and it's a story of a small village temple where a monk looked after in Japan near a fishing village. And one day a group of enraged villagers came to the gate of the temple with a very embarrassed looking teenage girl and a small bundle with a baby, and they pounded on the gate and great bluntness, they said, "Well, you know, she's told us all about the affair that you've been having together, and this is your child, so it's up to you to take care of him. You brought him into the world, so it's your job to raise him. And then handed him the baby and dragged the girl off, and as they're all standing there, you know, seeing what he's going to do, he reaches out, says, "Well," takes hold of the baby and says, "Oh, well, if you say it's so, then I'll take care of the child." "Well, it's your child, you know, it's up to you, you know, you brought him into the world, it's your responsibility." "If you're convinced that that's so, then that's fine, I'll take him." And I said, "What do you mean, you can't deny this? You got to take the child. It's your child." "Oh, is that so? Well, okay, I'll take the child." And so then he takes the child in, and then over the years, there's a few villagers that continue to support the temple, but most are still resentful of his disgraceful conduct with having an affair with a girl from the village and producing an illegitimate offspring. And as time goes by, he raises the child and grows up to be 5 years old, 10 years old, 15 years old, and finally, after about 20 years, as the child has grown up in the temple and is now a young man and has sort of become a fixture of the temple life, then the young woman who has now grown up and has been carrying around her own secret for all these years, finally is unable to bear the secret any longer, and she's also got married and has had her own legitimate children by now. And finally, one day, she tells her husband, "You know, the child that I said was from the village priest, from the monk up at the temple. You know, he wasn't really the father. You know, it was actually one of the fisherman's sons that I was having an affair with at the time, but I was so afraid that he would get beaten and thrown out of the village because we were unmarried, that I blamed the priest, and so all these years he's been looking after the child, and I felt terribly guilty just because I was trying to save the neck of my boyfriend at the time. But I feel terrible about having the priest had that responsibility." And so her husband then sees that she's being very sincere, and then he starts to spread it around, and soon the village people gather again in their large gang and head up the hill back up to the temple and knock on the temple door and say, "Venerable sir," he says, "Yes." He says, Well, "we understand that actually 20 years ago, when we brought the baby to the temple gate and we accused you of being the father, we were quite wrong, and actually, you know, this young man is not your son at all, but actually he's the son of the fisherman." And the girl says, "Oh, is that so? Oh, well, if you say so." "So he's quite content here, but if he wants to go off and join with the other part of his family, then that's quite all right too." And so then, as the story ends, then the young man goes off and starts his life outside the temple, and the priest's reputation from having been muddy for 20 years, suddenly he's regarded with incredible veneration, because he was prepared to have his reputation muddied, and for his own actions to be misunderstood, and to have been prepared to be maligned and look bad in other people's eyes without complaining and without arguing, without getting angry, and taking responsibility for raising this child through their whole adolescence and to adulthood without complaint. So then they held him in extremely high regard, and he was very highly venerated, so that the the quality of disrepute then flipped over into fame. It also reminds me of an incident in our monastery where this was one of the junior monks at Abhayagiri kind of confessed this to me a few years ago, where when I came to America, and I had been at Amaravati Monastery in England and at Chithurst, I've been about 15 years of the monasteries in England, and during much of that time I'd always tried to be involved in as many things as possible and as helpful as possible in all the work projects and administration and everything. I was the monk who said yes whenever anything had to be done. I would always volunteer and help out. But also, I realized that after a number of years, I was somewhat sort of compulsively, I was a compulsive helper. And I was also, as time went by, there was more and more things I found myself responsible for and involved in, and I was just spread so thin. So the last couple of years at Amaravati Monastery, I started to teach myself, not very successfully, how to say no, and not be involved, and not volunteer, let other people do things. And that was kind of hard work, but I saw that I really needed to do that in order to focus more on the main jobs that I had, and that it was quite okay for other people to volunteer as well. It was quite okay for things not to get done. So anyway, by the time I came to the States and we started up Abhayagiri, then I had a similar intention. So I set it up that there's a lot that's got to be done in the monastery, and much building work and things that require attention. But I have to remember I can't be doing everything. I can't volunteer for everything. I can't be involved in every kind of project. So I'll just limit myself to what fits within the day and consciously lay aside a lot of things that I might involve myself in, but I'll just that others can do better than I can. I'll just leave it and just take care of the main things and try to live in a balanced way and let that be its own message. So anyhow, so what the way this came out was, I was often involved in sort of teaching or doing administration stuff, answering mail, and kind of stuck in the office or answering phone calls or traveling here and there, and not so often out on the work site helping out with the various construction tasks and such like things on the mountainside. So anyway, one of the junior monks, well, he was someone who I'd known when he was a layman. He came and took on Anagarika life, and Abhayagiri, became a novice, and then became a monk. And he confessed to me that he'd got this view of me that I was kind of work shy, but actually I really liked just hanging out in the. I didn't like to get grubby. Didn't like to sort of exert myself. They could be out slaving away on the hillside, digging trenches and carrying timber and hacking out trails, and I would be busy on the telephone or sending emails or chatting for hours on end about nothing very important to all the visitors and people who just happened to drop in, and that I was a kind of lazy office bound bureaucrat type, and that I wasn't really part of the didn't really care for the work scene and didn't want to be involved in that. And then we had this weekend of teachings about Ajahn Chah back in 2001, Life and Teachings of Ajahn Chah, which was held down in, I think the Sati Center organized it down in the peninsula. And it was a really grand occasion, and quite a few of the former monastics were gathered together, people who'd known Ajahn Chah back in the early days. And so they gathered there as well. And amongst them was Kitty Saro, who had who had been a monk for about 15 years, and he and I sort of had begun pretty much at the same time. He arrived in Thailand about 2 years before I did, but we were very good friends in Thailand, and then later on in England, we were there at Chithurst Monastery back in the early 80s together. And anyway, this young monk and Kittisaro got chatting one day, and somehow I came up in conversation, and I wasn't there for this, I just heard about it afterwards. And Kittisaro was sort of talking about our friendship and how long we'd known each other, and he was saying, oh yeah, Amaro, he was really amazing, you know, when we were at Chithurst together, every day, whenever it was the work period, he was always the first one to get there for the work period, always the last one to finish, he was always clearing up after everybody else, you know, and this whole kind of litany of energetic features of you know, all the things that I did, and how you know, as he, this monk was hearing this, he was having this sort of oh dear feeling. He was hearing the sound of his own kind of complaining mind about, you know, Ajahn Amaro, he always just sits there, he just sits around, he doesn't really care about us, he doesn't really make any effort, he doesn't even want to get dirty, you know, out in the Mendocino dust. And so it was quite a powerful revelation. It was rather like the villagers showing up at the temple 20 years later. It's like, you know, oh dear, well, the picture that I had is rather different than this other one. And I'm not sort of telling this story just because I wanted to talk about me. But just it was a kind of an example close to home of how do we deal with praise and criticism and the way that people see us or the way we think that people see us. Yeah. Because that can move us, can motivate us enormously. Yeah. Wanting praise, fearing criticism, wanting to be understood. And one of the things that in this light, that when I was at those last couple of years at Amaravati, when I first started to work on this, I realized I was kind of addicted to praise, or addicted to sort of always being helpful. And so when I started to back off and just let other people do things, or not be volunteering, and not being this sort of helpful person all the time, that even in those times, people think, Ajahn Amaro is not half as helpful as he used to be, or he's gone all selfish, or he's, you know, his mind's in California, he doesn't really care about us anymore. These are quotations, yeah. But I realized that one of the most important things was I had to learn how to be misunderstood. And that I found was really insightful, that because when, you know, you'd hear sort of rumors or get bits of feedback or overhear people, and something in you would want to splutter, but no, it's not like that, you know, let me explain. But I realized that actually it's much, much more skillful for us to, like monk, the Japanese monk in the temple, to learn how to be misunderstood and to, you know, to trust our own integrity, to do what we do and let the world make of it what it will. And that if we're going to be misunderstood, if people don't see exactly why we do what we do, well, so be it. Ah. And then if people, you know, I'm sure everyone here, we've all done that, where we start writing stories about why so-and-so is behaving like that. You know, he does this because of such and such. How could he possibly do this? Or, you know, she's so great, she always does such and such. And we create these plots, these scenarios, these descriptions, and believe in them heartily, you know, invest in them, and these are just the worldly winds. This is the heart investing in praise and criticism, in fame and disrepute, and is being blown around, guided by those. Gain and loss, similarly, happiness and unhappiness. But one of the so it's windy, right? Okay, we've got the message now. It's there's wind around and we easily get blasted. And so as I was saying, you know, it's good for us to recognize that being moved, the heart being blown around, the jitta being shaken by these forces, these are very instinctual and deeply rooted mental states, habits. They're not really happening. Maybe they emerge as conceptual thought, or they come out as verbal thoughts and ideas. But the actual motivation of them is kind of pre-verbal. It's sort of down in the amygdala, reptile brain regions, the sort of reactive, instinctual, non-conceptual. Ooh, like it. Ugh, get away from it. Yeah. Ooh, it's going to kill me. Ooh, what can I eat it? Kind of basic instinct realms, and then it gets dressed up with a little bit of, you know, social decoration and justification of one kind or another. But these are potent forces. So we can't solve them just with trying to deciding that we're not going to be bothered by them. Just having an intention, or deciding, oh, I'm not going to be moved by praise and criticism. I'm not going to be upset by gain and loss. We can't just decide not to be moved by the wind, but we can use the power of thought and wise reflection to help create a pathway into really knowing those feelings and understanding them and seeing where they come from, by that seeing, through that seeing of what they are and their essential empty nature, then we can find that place of unshakenness, that profound stillness of heart, that security of heart. So one of the ways that I found of doing this is in a way, it's part of what the Buddha called jitanupassana, or the contemplation of mind states. So that it's using mindfulness, like in the Buddha's description of the four foundations of mindfulness. This is the third of the four elements of it, jitanupassana. So, and when the Buddha describes this, he says, knowing the angry mind is angry, knowing the mind free of anger is free of anger, knowing the expanded mind is expanded, the contracted mind is contracted, the agitated mind is agitated, the unagitated mind is unagitated, and so forth, through a long list of different states, different moods. And so, to really apply that, or to make use of that, is what I found is the most helpful way of working with those instinctual reactions to happiness, unhappiness, and gain and loss, and so forth. So that when we are experiencing a mood of, say, that we are we've won a prize, or that we've written a book and it's highly praised, or we have somebody tells us that they love us, or some marvelous. You suddenly realize that when you put your apartment on the market, it is actually 40% more worth, 40% more than you even in your wildest dreams dared fantasize. Wow, that's great! That's amazing. This thing, this kind of dumpy little apartment that I bought for what I thought was, outrageous amount of money, 100 grand, 15 years ago. Now they tell me it's worth 900. This is insane. This is great. So at that moment of the, wow, this is great, that feeling, that to practice with it wisely, then what we can do is to use that power of reflection. Say, oh, this is the wow, that's great feeling. This is what it feels like to get what we want, to have a surprise success, This is the deliciousness of success. Or similarly, when my friend woke up and realized that his entire stock portfolio was now suitable for lining the bottom of the birdcage and not much else. But, oh, this is the feeling of intense loss. This is the I've lost everything feeling. And so what we can do is that it's like a thorough tracking all of those swayings of mood, and that there's always some things that it's easy to spot in that way, that are not so loaded, that it, you know, looks like, oh, this is the feeling of seeing a beautiful object, or this is the feeling of a disgust at an unpleasant taste, lightly weighted things. And there's other things that are just so loaded, so powerful that that we don't even get anywhere near recognizing that it's a feeling, because, you know, this is a real thing that's happening, and this is bad, this is terrible, this is the worst has happened, that my beloved has just died, or this is my money, it's all gone. Well, that's my car, how can I do that to my car? Someone took my car, or my reputation. How can they? I write this book, and actually, come to think of it, another good example was this book that I did I think last year, called Small Boat, Great Mountain, as I was putting that together, I thought, well, I know it's just a book, and I know we're not supposed to, as good monastics, we're not supposed to be tying ourselves to worldly, activities and think sort of worldly creations, and really the fruit of a monastic life is should be seen in terms of the realization of Dhamma, and not just material objects, but in terms of having brought some kind of material object into the world. Yeah, I'm really glad I did this. This is a job well done. I'm really glad to have sort of brought these words together, and the occasion that brought this forth, a wonderful retreat with Sokhne Rinpoche, and that was a great time, and all these good people came together to help put this book into print and edit it, and Rona Kabatsnik and Joe Curran, and all these kind of good people that helped out with doing the indexing, and somebody even created a whole font to print it in, and then there's it's full of stuff that people say is useful, and they found helpful and inspiring. So it's one thing I'm really glad that I've done with my life is to produce this book. That I can be sure of. I never thought that about anything else before. So you could see what was happening, where it was going. It was like, this is the one thing I'm really glad that I did. Yes, this is good. So of course, even though I've written and done all kinds of other things, Then to my surprise, shock, horror, 6 months later, I find that a certain group of monastics in a different country, thinking, this is heretical, this is totally wrong view, this is absolutely... And I really didn't realize this was coming. I hadn't got a clue this was in the pipeline until I got a phone call from a monk saying, it wasn't a phone call. He wrote a letter saying, I'd like to ask you a few questions about your book. Is that all right? And I said, sure, if there's not too many. And I was remembering another slightly overzealous young monk who wrote to Ajahn Tanisro down at Wat Metta with some. He said, can I ask a few questions about your Vinaya book? And he said, sure. And he sent him a list of 160. So my appeal was, okay, I can answer some questions, but as long as there's not too many. And I got this letter which was, what was it? It was 16 pages long with 8 pages of notes. And it was all like, even though it was in the form of questions on one level, it was more like, a kind of anguished diatribe against my multiple wrong views, cast in the form of questions. So anyway, I contacted him and said, well, we can talk on the phone, but I can't answer your letter in print. And by the way, I said, as long as there weren't too many questions. Well, there was only 8 questions. I said, but they were 16 pages. There was 8 questions, strung out over 16 pages. So it was kind of ironic. It was like that there was this one thing that there was this moment of genuine relish. And it wasn't something I was carrying around, but there was at least one moment of, I'm really glad I did this. Even if I died now, my life will not have been wasted. At least I've left this behind in the world. It's like, okay, just put your... just lie down on the freeway, just right here. the truck will be along in a minute. It was totally asking for it. And so, there you go. You invest in a worldly dhamma, and then boom, back it comes. And so and I did get lots of praise for the book, and the praise was sweet. But then the opposite is bitter. So if we're practicing wisely with that, then what one does is say, oh, this is the sweetness of praise. When people appreciate what you do, when they praise, it's like this. This is a sweet taste. It feels like this. And to let that really be known, the kind of visceral quality of that feeling, this is what it feels like. When you're loved, when you're appreciated, it's like this. It is not intrinsically good. It feels good. It's a very pleasant feeling. So that it's like stepping away from that judgment in the mind that says, no, this is good. And this is not just a feeling. This is good. This is really good. Or when you're criticized, and then even better when you're unfairly criticized, when you're misunderstood, misquoted, misrepresented, and that is a bitter feeling. This is painful. This is the bitterness of being criticized or being misunderstood, misrepresented. And so I found that to be able to just know that feeling, to fully digest it, to let yourself really be with that, to let the registering of it, oh, this is the bitterness of being criticized, of being rejected, being hated, being misunderstood. It feels like this. And to use the reflection to bring you into the full acknowledgement of the feeling, And we can sense those kind of things in different parts of the body. We hold them in different ways. Maybe that happiness is a sort of a warm glow in the heart, and that criticism is a sort of a bear trap around the neck, or whatever. We each have our own flavors and experiences. But it's to recognize, oh no, this isn't bad. This isn't wrong. This is just the feeling of wrongness. This is the feeling of badness. And without any kind of interpretation or of any sort of dishonesty or bias in any way whatsoever, without any kind of distortion, we can say, this is the feeling. And when we really train ourselves to do that, then we begin to see that, at least is what I've found for myself, is that the habitual repertoire of things that we'll be objective to and see, this is just a feeling and it's impermanent and not self, is kind of small. And that it takes a conscious expansion of that repertoire this is one of them too. This judgment, that's bad, that's terrible, how can I do that? This is a feeling that is bad. This is feeling that someone shouldn't be that way. or that this is a feeling, or that's good, that's right, this is a good thing. No, this is a feeling. This is a pleasant feeling that, about celebrating that these people have got it right. So that what you're doing in this, it's not just a kind of dissociation and a divorce from one's experience with life, but in a strange, sort of mysterious and ironic way, even though it can seem like one is just sort of distancing and making a sort of, you're just trying to be this inert observer that's collecting the data of pleasant, painful, and neutral. That's when we're really doing this from a way that's in accordance with Dhamma, then what happens is that we're actually losing the barriers that we create between things through those judgments of this is right, that's wrong, this is beautiful, that's ugly, this is good, that's bad. This, you know, gain is good, loss is bad. fame is good, disrepute is bad. Happiness is good, unhappiness is bad. Where those judgments, those kind of investing in those, is actually what causes layers and layers of barriers around the heart. It actually is dissociating our sensitivity from the greater world. We're actually more isolated, more alienated, the more that we believe in those value judgments. And the more that they're dissolved or seen for what they are, then what happens is that the heart can freely respond in terms of compassion and kindness or equanimity or sympathetic joy. That the Brahma Viharas are the guiding principles as to how what a response is. Because when we say, oh, this is just a happy feeling, or this is just a feeling of sadness, you know, when you see some kind of, when you're in the middle of some kind of tragic event, or you see someone close to you that's falling apart and there's nothing you can do about it, or with the great, you know, horrors of the scenes in New Orleans and in the southeast of the United States, you know, intense feelings come up, and it's not a matter of just saying, oh, it's just a feeling, you know, therefore I don't want to bother. It's like, yeah, this is a feeling of sadness or of intense compassion. This is the feeling, this is what we feel, this is what arises in relationship to that event or being with people who are in the middle of that. This is what arises. And so then, by fully knowing that, in an unbiased and clear way, really allowing that into the heart, then the heart is unbiased in its response. And then if we find if there's something that we can do, then we do it. If there's nothing that for us to be able to do, then we leave it alone. But we leave it alone with a good heart. If we are trying to be, say, helpful, compassionate to others from a sort of an undharmic way, from a sort of habitual, from a compulsive way, or just driven by an idealism, then what we find is that if somebody needs help and we can't do anything for them, then we feel guilty because we have, you know, they're still suffering. Yeah. But sometimes it really is out of our capacity. There's nothing that we can do. And so then to pile a sense of guilt onto ourselves on top of that is actually creating a barrier to any kind of empathy. So that sometimes there's no thing that we can do to help another person. But even just recognizing that it's out of our hands. Yeah, it's not because we don't care. It's not because we're unconnected. It's because there's nothing that can be done. So the empathy is still there, even though on one level we can't help. And that was one of the things that I found most striking when I first went to live in Asia and picking up a sense of how people operated in the Buddhist country, was that people did what they did to be helpful, And what they couldn't do, they didn't worry about. And I'd never had that experience in my life before. I'd always been like, oh, I want to do more, I want to be able to help, I want to. And if I couldn't, then I'd feel disappointed or frustrated with myself or guilty because they were still suffering and it was my fault for not being helpful, not being able to do something about it. But there was this way that of lightness that is the abiding quality that's there when we really function according to Dhamma, when we kind of develop this attunement to the moment and release our habitual biases and our our kind of defenses are dropped. There's a strange thing. You might think, well, it's very windy out there, you know, all these worldly winds, I need to be defended against the windiness of the world. I've got to bolt myself down and not move. So we can kind of tense up and try to resist through just muscle power. But actually, what enables us to be unshaken, or the heart to be unshaken, is that relinquishment of those kind of barriers, and to begin to trust our own heart, and to go to that, to be able to be ready to feel those feelings, to know them, to know whether they're mild or very intense, to be able to acknowledge, yeah, this too is one of them. Oh yeah, this one I really thought was real, but no, this is still just a feeling. This is extraordinarily strong or incredibly personal or very embarrassing or really exciting. Oh no, this is just one of those. This is what it is. No need to get frightened or off-put, no need to get overwhelmed, excited. And that's the place of stability, that's the place of stillness, of peacefulness. And the asokang virajang kemang, and beyond all sorrow, spotless, secure. This is the highest blessing. So I offer these thoughts for reflection this evening.